Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before we get started, I just want to ask a favor. I want you to check out Joe Trippi's podcast, That Trippi Show. You can find it wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Add that to your Lincoln Project listening. That Trippi Show, twice a week, wherever you find podcasts. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by Regis McKenna, a legendary marketer in the tech sector. Regis has been described as the man who put Silicon Valley on the map and developed many of the marketing techniques that are now commonplace to modern-day advertisers. He and his firm were instrumental in the launch of some of the most innovative products of the computer age, including the first microprocessor with Intel, Apple's first personal computer, and the Byte Shop, the first retail computer store. Today, he's a sought-after consultant, lecturer, and sits on numerous advisory boards. However, he's joining the Lincoln Project podcast as a proud member of the Pro-Democracy Coalition. Regis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Reed.
So, you know, I want to talk about Silicon Valley and how it came to be the epicenter of the tech sector as it is today, as well as what responsibilities you believe the tech sector has to our nation. But before that, let's get into your extremely fascinating background. So you're originally from Pittsburgh, and went out to Silicon Valley in 1962. And there's a lot to talk about, but first, why California?
Well, there was not many jobs left in Pittsburgh when I graduated school. You know, it was the steel capital world and that industry had vanished. You know, I try as I might, I had gotten married and needed a job. So I got a job at a technical publisher and I worked there for several years, basically learning everything about the publishing business. And in the course of doing that, since they published technical magazines as well as books, I became sort of a copywriter and editor and those sorts of things along the way. I picked up a little bit of technology, though my background, my education was philosophy.
That makes sense.
Well, it does actually. It turned out to be a very good background because it teaches you to think. And, you know, in the information age, which I then was transferred to the West Coast to open their West Coast office here in Northern California. And I did that in 1963. So I was fairly young, and it was the days whenever there weren't many companies here in Silicon Valley. It wasn't called Silicon Valley, but Lockheed was here. There were some aerospace companies. Hewlett-Packard was here. They were founded in the 1940s. And there were a few semiconductor companies. Startups, Fairchild was the main company, out of which almost every other semiconductor company in Silicon Valley spun out. So, you know, it was a good time to be here because housing and property were still relatively inexpensive and the industry was in its initial stages. So if you wanted to get an MBA in the growth of technology, those were the days to go to work for the tech industry in the 1960s, early 60s, and then into the 70s. The integrated circuit was only invented in the late 50s. So it really hadn't even achieved market size. In fact, when I did join a semiconductor company, my first projects were marketing transistors. And the transistors were about the size of a straight pin with a little head on it. But those then had to be assembled into, well, you know, the Sony transistor radio and those sorts of things. So it took really thousands of transistors to make any type of instrument viable and put it into the hands of consumers. So that was a good time to be there because the companies were small. You got to know everybody. You got to ask a lot of questions. You saw the whole process. The company that I first went to work for after I left the publishing company was a company that not only made the ingots, the silicon ingots, but they sliced them and they made the masks, they made the patterns, they made their own integrated circuits, they packaged them, and they even at the end made calculators. So you could sort of see the beginning of it and the end of it and where it went. And you got involved in all the stages. And it wasn't a very big company at that time.
So explain to me and the folks listening, because the integrated circuit is ubiquitous and we rely on it right up until this moment and will, I assume, for many, many, many eons to come. What is an integrated circuit?
All right, an integrated circuit is literally integrating transistors onto one common substrate, silicon.
So is this a microchip?
Yeah, but the microchips had different forms. And, you know, the first ones were really simple functions. What was really the revolution came a few years later, although the first company I was with that I was mentioning, they tried to develop a technology. It was called MOS, and that was metal on oxide on semiconductors, or silicon, rather. And that technology was literally financed by the government, U.S. government, particularly the Department of Defense, because at that time we were in a space race with Russia. And if you, some of you who have been around, recall that our missiles barely left the ground and many of them just failed.
Well, there's that infamous scene from The Right Stuff.
Right.
Where they have about 45 seconds of just rockets crashing on the pad.
Right. And so the Russians had, they were able to develop very powerful rockets so they could move heavy payloads into space where the U.S. was struggling to do that. And one of the concepts was to reduce the electronics on board, the computers. And to do that, you had a miniaturized device. You couldn't have it filled with vacuum tubes, which was running the early computers, large computers, transistors. It just was almost mind-boggling to think about how many transistors it would take. But if you integrated them all into very small devices and then connected those on one chip, and this became Moore's Law. So Gordon Moore, who was one of the founders of Fairchild and Intel, he noticed that those chips were doubling every 18 months. In other words, you could add more and more as you learned the process. So it was the learning curve of starting out, experimenting, moving up the spectrum, deciding what to change, how to integrate new materials, new ways of manufacturing, new ways of shrinking the transistors down to smaller and smaller units. An example of this really is the first computers, you know, maybe Apple's first computers had maybe 25,000 different transistors in it. My watch has 5 billion. The newer products are even double that. And so they've just come up with new ways, new tools. So it's spun off a whole new industry, not only of the semiconductor industry, but of industries that create the materials, as well as the devices that make the semiconductors. So, you know, when I was at a company called General Microelectronics, I headed up a technical writing group and we wrote proposals to mostly the military, but to other people about the technology. And actually teaching people about the technology was a large percentage of our revenue because we started selling classes. So it was a little bit like a very sophisticated computer and you got to educate people how to use them and what the difference is between that and simply an integrated circuit. So the MOS devices had a different kind of structure to them that allowed lower power. They could put more transistors closer together. They were faster. I mean, this has probably 1,000 more times power than the original Apollo computer.
Right. So it started with defense contractors. When did the microchip start to make its way into the lives of everyday people?
That was really the microprocessor. That was a device that it had memory. It had much more logic on it. It was not simply an array of actions. It was simply a much more complex chip that allowed you to reprogram it. So you could make a prototype, but you could also make it and remake it very quickly on the production line because you could reprogram the chip. And that really happened with Intel. That took them roughly 10 years to be successful because the microchip, the first one was in 1972. And then it was the microcomputer itself, the personal computer, that really created the mass market that allowed them to sell volumes of these chips out there into the public. But it replaces so many other functions, particularly electrical functions, that, for example, when the first Prius came out, it had 150 microprocessors in it. Now, Bob Noyce, who was the inventor of the integrated circuit, one of the inventors of the integrated circuit and founder of Intel, he used to say that the average home had about 25 fractional horsepower motors in it. You know, you had them in a hairdryer, you had them in fans, all kinds of things in your home, power tools. Well, today you probably have more than 500 microchips in your home. You just don't see them, but they're performing actions that used to be done and they're much cheaper and lower power, so you don't have to always recharge them.
Right. So, you know, let's fast forward a little bit. So when you and I first met, I was told that you were the person who wrote the marketing plan for Apple Computer and that that plan now sits, I believe, in the library at Stanford. Is that right?
Yes.
So talk to us a little bit about starting with Jobs and Wozniak. Like, what was that like?
Well, at that time, I had already been doing the marketing work for Intel. Well, Apple's marketing plan I wrote in December of 1976, and it's in a notebook, you're correct. But I have about 100, 150 notebooks at Stanford that are digitized now, but not released. And in that notebook, we sat down and probably with the team at Apple, including Steve, and sort of gathered thoughts, and then I put together into a, it's a handwritten plan. But in there, I put Apple stores as a distribution channel. And that was really a personal experience because with both Apple and Intel, they were very collegial kinds of environment. You know, although I was an outside consultant, had my own agency, you know, I didn't have a badge or anything like that. You just worked with the teams inside. So you became part of their marketing department or part of their corporate staff, whatever. In fact, I was on Apple's corporate staff for probably about 10 years. And I was the only, you know, non-employee to do that. And so they wanted to generate ideas about marketing because it hadn't existed before. And we had experience in doing a whole number of products, particularly high-tech products that had not been introduced to the world before. In fact, I think the number is something like 10 or 12 new inventions. In fact, not only the Apple computer, but also things like recombinant DNA, which was the process that came out of Genentech that revolutionized drug development and allowed people to have synthetic insulin today rather than have it derived from pigs and cows. So there's a whole lot of those things that we had experience with. And during, and what I found out was that the world really needed educated about these products. It wasn't a question of promoting them because you could run an ad and people would say, well, what do I do with it? You know, I mean, the ad doesn't help at all. And so two things happened. One is the journalists who have been writing about integrated circuits and things of that nature, some of them were really technical, were engineers, and some of them understood it, but most readers couldn't understand the articles. The journalists and the analysts, even more important, started using the early Apples and the early personal computers. And that, all of a sudden, you know, the light went on, hey, this is how these things can be used. And as that market grew, their interest grew down the manufacturing chain, if you will. And Steve was a very creative guy. I mean, he didn't have an education in engineering or software or management or an MBA, but he absorbed things very, very quickly, and he anticipated things, and he worked very closely with us. And as a result, after going through things, I'm sure this plan came out of a lot of those meetings in terms of me just taking notes and then going back and organizing them. And I did that at Intel as well. I have one on the first microprocessor, in which are for early meetings on that. And the first line I have is, what is a microprocessor?
There you go. I'm still asking that question today, I guess.
Yes.
So you and I were talking, I don't know if it was last week or we've had several conversations. Talk about when, I'm going to use the phrase Silicon Valley because I think it's shorthand, when Silicon Valley went to Washington. And this goes a little bit back to my earlier question about, like, when did this come into the consciousness of anybody other than folks in the defense sector? But talk about how when the guys who are running these things and growing these companies first went to Washington and the experience they had.
Well, prior to the semiconductor industry and the new tech era, there were a number of companies in the United States that were in consumer, what they called consumer electronics, sort of Sony. There was a company here, for example, called Ampex. And Ampex made tape recorders and tape machines. And that company went out of business, but largely because Japan Inc. came in with cheaper, better products. And so that kept happening to companies after companies after companies. When the semiconductor industry came in, then Japan started making, you know, some of the same things. And there was concern because they started selling their devices, you know, below cost, and they were partly financed by their government. And so some of the trade regulations and trade laws really prohibited things that at least the people here in the United States felt were not giving them a level playing field. So it was the semiconductor industry and their battle with Japan to, first of all, get the market open, but also to make sure that they weren't selling below costs and that the government understood that this was a vital industry to the health and safety of the United States, economic health of the United States. And the leaders of that formed basically an organization called SIA, Semiconductor Industry Association. And I was an advisor on that. And Bob Noyce, who invented the integrated circuit and was part of the transistor development team at Shockley, Charlie Spork, who founded National Semiconductor, and Jerry Sanders, who founded American Microsystems, were sort of the leaders of that. And so I had suggested we go back and talk to some of the people in Congress about these issues and about other things and why it's an important industry for them to acknowledge and to pay attention to. And what they got was, these were people who were really pretty simple people. Bob Noyce was a son of a minister born, you know, in the Midwest. Charlie Spork was the son of a grocer. They were sort of flabbergasted by the fact that the politicians would turn and say, yeah, but we haven't gotten any money from you yet. They just could not believe it, that people had to be bribed to do their job. They were pretty bewildered by that. But it wasn't any better, because when we went up to New York and we talked to people like at the New York Times and others, they wrote, well, semiconductor industry looking for bailout. And so the world seemed a little confused to them. And I think that what came along was that at that time was that, you know, the Republicans were in power. And I suggested, why don't we turn to the Democrats? They need subject to fight the world with. And so we did. And we started getting not only voices, but we started getting visits. I introduced some of the people here to Anna Eshoo and Jerry Brown. Also, I had a dinner here at the house with high-tech people and Jerry Brown when he was in office. And it did the same with Clinton. And they both held their own against these really, you know, I had about, five or 10 high-tech people from both the biotech and the software and the computer industry and the semiconductor industry. And they really challenged them. But quite frankly, they showed, hey, we can stay toe-to-toe with you. And they were very impressed by that. And I think that for at least a period of time created a much more upsurge in Democratic attention here in the Valley. Clinton visited here probably 15, 20 times. He was just here 2 weeks ago, you know, and he's still interested. In fact, he called a friend of mine who was also involved and said he'd like to get some of the old gang together. And so we had a dinner with him. But everything changes, and that's not the way it is today.
Let's talk about the change, because you go through the 80s, right? And chips are being included in more and more things. Around that same time, and it's probably started earlier, but ARPANET, which would become, I guess, the internet, is a bunch of guys in the Pentagon, a bunch of college research centers that are connecting to one another. And now all of a sudden, there's a commercial use for these things. And the internet starts to create so much more opportunity out there, because now you can connect people faster than instantaneously. So what did the introduction of the internet do to the Valley?
I think it was a big event for not only the Valley, but for the world and for culture around the world. And I have two folders here. One is called Democracy and one is called Political Culture. So most of the articles in there, a lot of the articles go back to the early 70s, some in the 60s. And I was reading through them and you see that we were warned about this new technology. Now there's two things there. One is that you become sort of anti-technology, but the other one is that the technology starts being used for things you didn't anticipate. So there are unintended consequences. But when you get 5 billion people talking to one another across the world, we've suddenly moved from broadcasts, which used to be able to have, what, 3 or 4 channels on their TV set. We're now having literally billions of channels because everybody's their own broadcaster. And you don't need to get an FCC license to do it. And so what I talk about is the fact that I gave a talk in Washington on this, and I point out that the internet had a downside to it. And in fact, was that every time you have something that really matters, there's going to be antimatter. And so antimatter kills matter. And so I had this sort of slide with, you know, two figures in a tug of war. And one was, you know, what matters and what doesn't matter. And one is matter and antimatter. And so people to like negative things better or the bad news better or accept it better or whatever, that happens. And so we get more negative things. I have one slide that I use, which is a study that was done through Twitter, was that people are happier now today than they ever were. And then below was a same page with somebody that posted a study that was done on more people have put on hate subjects on Twitter than before. And so, you know, you got this conflict of good and bad, positive and negative. I've jokingly have said that the polarities of the earth change every now and then. It's not anything that's planned. It just happens. And it happened, I think, in about 2015 or 2017. The polarities changed. And I said, well, yeah, black became white, white became black, truth became fiction, fiction became truth. And I think that somehow or other, we're in a world that is so complex. People are frightened of the new world. They don't know how to adjust to it. They don't know how to live in it. And politicians know nothing about it. You know, I ended up in 1998, around 1997, 98, I wrote a book called Real Time. And the follow-on was And the Age of the Never Satisfied Consumer. And so if you look at technology, it's getting faster and faster. You know, the Buckminster Fuller's knowledge doubling curve, you know, it says that in year 2000, the total amount of knowledge in the world doubled every 3 to 5 years. Well, lately they've been talking about it doubling every few hours. I mean, an example of this is the genome in 1977. This is one of my slides. They said that to complete the genome, they had done 3 mappings of the human genome in 1977, and that it would take another 4 million years to do the human genome. The human genome was done in 2003, 3.4 billion base pairs. And so each year, it looks like things are going to take longer, but in fact, it's happening faster. And it's happening faster because the knowledge is essentially doubling its capability along Buckminster Fuller's curve.
But can I ask you a philosophical question? And maybe it's a neurological question, but I'm going to frame it philosophically. All of these things that you're talking about from a knowledge base speed up repeatedly every day, every 3-4 hours, whatever. But like, we haven't evolved as a species like to keep up, right? Like if we had, like, we'd be giant heads sitting on little bodies, and we're not, because we're not supercomputers.
No, but it has an impact on us, even if it's not conscious. I mean, there are new words that came into our vocabulary in the last 20 years, and they're all tech words, and we use them. So it changes us just like the remote control changes us. It teaches us that we can customize what we want to look at, even though we're not making a conscious choice to do that. But now, you know, you really do. And quite frankly, look at the numbers of, you know, entertainment sources you now have in terms of, you know, Netflix or whatever, where you can go on and look at, you know, whatever movies you want to in any kind of genre.
But even that, like, let's say that you're a celebrity person, that entertainment, Hollywood is your thing. I mean, you could probably just spend all day reviewing sites, blogs, Twitter feeds, Instagram accounts, Facebook accounts on nothing but, say, Taylor Swift all day, every day, right? Like, you could literally live in a Taylor Swift-centric world and never run out of things to read, watch, see, gossip about. That's how specific it feels like this world can be for someone. Like, I'm going to find the thing that I'm interested in, that I'm totally into, and the rest of it, like, yeah, I got to eat, I got to sleep, I got to work. But outside of that, like, this has my attention.
But that conglomerate of news around one focused element is what competes with the noise coming out of the political world. So I used to say, you know, that the political world is competing with Tiger Woods. He was more on television, and people's not going to sit in there and watch a speech from a candidate. And so today, I think that one issue that we have is the way to overcome that is to create what the internet was intended originally for, dialogue. And we don't have dialogue. The people are using the internet today as if it were a broadcast media. And broadcast is one way. So the solution that I said, you know, in real time was that you've got to create these dialogues and have your customers talk back to you. And it started with putting 800 number, and, you know, the Pepsi can had an 800 number on it. And then they started putting websites on it. And so they started that way. But as important as the political influences on our daily lives are, you can't do that without having a dialogue that creates that relationship with someone. And that's because services, people don't change their services. You don't change your doctor very often, and people don't change their bank very often. So services are much different than a product. I mean, when you make a decision, let's say a Pepsi or Coke, it's not going to cost you that much, even if you make the wrong choice. But when you make a choice for a heart surgeon, you want a lot of knowledge and you want experience. And so these sorts of elements in our lives that make a difference are on that level of heart surgeon than they are on a Pepsi or Coke. But we're using Pepsi and Coke to sell candidates. We're branding them. Branding, I used to shiver every time I heard somebody talk about, well, we're going to brand this candidate as this or that. When in effect, that's not what people want. They don't want a brand. They want somebody who's going to continue to change and develop and work with them as their lives move forward.
You're absolutely right, which is, what is this candidate's brand? And I think that maybe an individual voter might be swayed by that. But I feel like even now, even with all the stuff that we're talking about, voters writ large can still spot a phony when they see one.
Yeah, apparently there's several million people out there that haven't spotted it yet.
You know, that's a good point. And I think this goes to your idea of broadcast, which is, let's take a Donald Trump, for example. For the people to whom Trump is even to this day so central, they believe that he is speaking individually to them. And he claims to be hearing them and he's heard them. So maybe it's a false broadcast. Maybe he's making it up because that's what he does with most things. But he's maybe the exception that proves the rule, which was he understood instinctually how to reach his people, right? And does it even to this day, because this gets into a broader philosophical thing about, you know, he unearthed a wide swath of disaffection in the American people, some of it understandable given the sorts of disruption that we've been talking about and dislocation we've been talking about. But also to your point about whether or not the internet was meant for dialogue or broadcast, he claims dialogue, but it's really just broadcast, and it's broadcast to people's worst instincts.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you might want to read, or some of the people who are listening might want to go back and read, is there was an American historian by the name of Daniel Borstein, and he wrote a book called The Discoverers, which became very popular. But he also wrote a book, the little-known book called The Image, The Rise of Pseudo-Events in America. And a pseudo-event is something that either the media or people manufacture to create attention. And attention in America has become, in his words, what we call fame, and that is associated with skill and talent. I call it the Tevye effect. You know, in Fiddler on the Roof, Tevye sings a song, "If I Were a Rich Man." And he says, if I were a rich man, I'd sit in the temple and I'd lecture to the wise men, and it wouldn't matter if I'm right or wrong. When I'm rich, they think they know. And so, you know, you'll see a lot of these entrepreneurs like Musk and even Gates and others, you know, they're brought on to talk about everything from education to childcare. And so we've got our own oligarchs who have the attention of the media, and they are praised and put on a pedestal, when in effect, they really don't have knowledge of all those things. They have a lot of precedence before them in terms of people who develop technologies that allowed them to get where they are or to be who they are.
You mentioned Elon Musk, and I was reading a newsletter, you know, I get 100 of them a day, and it was like, where is Elon Musk going to spend his political capital? And I thought that that was such a silly question, Regis, because like, what political capital? I mean, he started Tesla. He started SpaceX. I mean, I think he started PayPal. Like, this is a very, very wealthy guy, very successful guy. But like, who's the Elon Musk constituency that everybody's so worried about? Does that make sense? So even otherwise very astute political reporters think because he's famous and on Twitter all the time and causing trouble by saying he's going to buy Twitter and, you know, maybe he likes Trump, maybe he likes this, that somehow now he's some sort of political force in his own right, when in fact, he's just a very wealthy guy who has created some amazing companies. He's not Tony Stark. He's not Iron Man. He's a sort of a goofy guy who, you know, did well.
I think that's absolutely true. But, you know, my point was that these people that we put on a pedestal, we then think that they're knowledgeable about all industries. Now, he may be a genius of some sort and understands all these things. But, you know, the Prius was out before his car, you know, and so you could look at the Prius and say, you know, that was sort of a team developed idea. And most of the electronics in his cars are manufactured or came together from other people, sort of like Steve Jobs did. I mean, Steve didn't invent all the technology in the iPhone, but he certainly recognized when it was available. He used to say he tries to look for what he called springtime technologies. That's technologies that are emerging, but not yet fully into the market, and then integrate them into his products. So it's like a Rubik's Cube, because it's all these pieces that if you sort of play the right color and the right size and so forth, you fit into the rest of the block, and it allows you the connections. I mean, I've also tracked the companies in Silicon Valley over the last 20 to 25 years. You know, when I first started to do it in 2000, there were 7 companies. There were over 5 billion. Today, there are almost 28 in Silicon Valley. And very few of the companies over the years have vanished. And those companies range from 5 billion to over 200 billion, as Apple. But there's also between 50 and 60 companies between 1 and 5 billion. So there's a lot of startups. And when people refer to Silicon Valley, they use the term generically, as if, you know, Silicon Valley's in trouble. Well, which company are you talking about?
Right.
Because they don't all agree. They don't all vote the same way. They don't all live in the same area. But the county of Santa Clara, which is where most of Silicon Valley is, has largely been 50-50 over the years in terms of voter registration. And so the people here are, I think they're a little bit more thoughtful. I know Republicans who have left very early when Trump came in. I know some who were on good political positions in Sacramento. And my wife was in politics for 30 years and held a lot of positions. So, you know, and by the way, her position, the positions here have always been nonpartisan. And you were asking me about when did it become partisan when we talked last time. And there was this proposition, I don't remember the number now, but it was on the ballot to essentially hold companies responsible for their forecasts. And there was a firm, law firm down, and I think it was San Diego, it was one of the people, it was a fellow by the name of Larac. And he was well known for having, you know, extracted hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, from particularly the high-tech industry, that he would look at their projections and then basically sue them for lying to the public or misleading the public. And they would pay off. And finally, they got tired of that. And they put this proposition came on where he actually had trial lawyers put the proposition on the ballot. And the industry got together. And this was during the Clinton administration. And they basically raised a lot of money to fight it. And Clinton actually came out here, and I had written him a letter about it. And his advisors told him not to get involved in it. But he came out and he sided with the industry. And what happened after that was the money was put into an organization that said, we're going to split it up into red and blue. And I was myself and a fellow named John Doerr, who was one of the founders of that group. John and I think were the two that were against that. You know, Dave Packard actually would support whatever politician supported growth in high technology and employment and a good economy. He always wanted the best of people. And quite frankly, I think that's what we were arguing for. Let's have a hearing for all these people. And then those who support what we think is important in the tech industry, we fund them, but not just because they're on one side or the other. And that got shot down.
Well, because also it became, we have to give to all these people. In fact, it was the president of Microsoft right after January 6th of 2021, Regis, who got caught on film saying, like, we have to give this money so we get our phone calls returned. And I was thinking to myself, now, Regis, he's the president of Microsoft. Like, if he can't get his phone call returned because he didn't give 5,000 bucks to some goober, like, that's a bigger problem. But that's how they see the world, or maybe that's how they excuse it.
No, I think that what happens is that they get to a certain level of power, like anybody else, and that power they think is extendable into the political realm. But you know what's happened, I think? I've seen a really pulling out of being involved in the political spectrum. There's not as many as there was in the 80s or in the early 90s in the high-tech world. You don't see them being as vocal and outspoken.
Well, you can also see that in a given hearing, we haven't had one in a while because of COVID and other things. But, you know, when congressional committees used to call Jack Dorsey, Mark Zuckerberg, the Google guys, any of these people up to testify, it was clear, Regis, that nobody sitting on that dais had any idea what they were talking about. And so they would hit them on whatever the most spectacular thing was, whatever their biggest failure, their biggest scandal was. But no one had any understanding of the underlying economics or technology or any of them.
Yeah, well, I have an interview that was done. It was Steve Jobs, and it was with Wired Magazine. The interviewer asked him, you know, how did he look the future coming? And he said, I'm very depressed over it. I don't think we're making progress at all. He said, I think we're going backwards. And one of the reasons is that he says, I don't think our politicians are getting smarter. And the other reason he said was that we don't seem to want to help our future children. And that's universal. I mean, my wife was county supervisor in Santa Clara County for two or three terms. And there was a budgets that they allocated a certain funds to senior projects and to children's projects. And the senior projects got most of the money. And she wanted to balance that out. So she was going to cut the seniors to fund more of the children's programs. And quite frankly, the AARP got all upset over it and really protested. And so they had to go back. But now I think we've gotten to the age where it really is a very self-centered world today in terms of, and I mean, individualist.
And, you know, it's interesting. I'm just about finished reading The Foundations of Authoritarianism by Hannah Arendt. Very light read, Regis.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
And one of the things she talks about, which is key for authoritarian movements, is something that you just hit on, which is the atomization of a population. That the more hyper-individualistic people are in a society, the more likely it is that you are able to capture them with the sort of movements that finally give them a place where they feel like they belong. Because everybody wants to belong to something. And if you can mix that with your problems or somebody else's fault and scream louder and say crazier things and promise everybody the world, then suddenly you can have a movement in which it's still very nihilistic. It's still very atomized, but they're all just, I guess, I don't know, they're free atoms floating together. They're not molecules.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up was, I don't think either many of the politicians, I shouldn't say all of them, or even people seriously interested in the future of the country have read much history.
Oh, well, that's for sure.
And as I went back through all the, you know, my folders and all the things that I have and all these books behind me, most of them are history books, is what you can learn from history and what you try to understand things differently. And I talked about this fragmentation one time to a friend of mine. His name was Pat Crassine. And Pat Crassine became president of Carnegie Mellon University. And he was also the president of Georgia Tech. And he was on the board of Next. But when he was really starting out, he was at University of Michigan. And he and another fellow, they were actually in the public policy studies, is what he and another fellow wrote a paper on it. And it's called Government and Politics, a Fragmented Society, Hard to Govern Democratically from Another Vantage Point. And if you read it, you will say, uh-huh, everything they say in here has happened. And this was in 1970, they wrote it.
It's interesting because I recently read, I've always been a John Steinbeck fan, another Northern Californian from Salinas. And I read Travels with Charlie as he drives around the country with his dog. And that was published in 1960, maybe 62. And there's so much in there, Regis, that like Steinbeck called out as he traveled 60 years ago. I was like, oh my God, he said this was going to happen and it happened. He said he was worried about this and it happened. And so that's to your point, which is, you know, there's that somebody, I don't know who the trope, it's that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it echoes. We don't have to say that what will happen in the United States will happen as it happened in Germany 1933, because it's two different places, everything else. But you can see, wait, we've seen this play before, right? And this one looks a heck of a lot like it. Now, what do we do about it now at Act Two to make sure there's not an Act Three?
Well, it's going to take different kinds of people in government from a policy standpoint and from a governing standpoint to really understand where we are and where we're going. And I don't see that kind of reflection going on. I also read the letters between Jefferson and Adams when they had retired, and they really felt that, particularly Jefferson felt that he hoped that the future people that were running the United States would be more statesmen than politicians, and that they would be more educated than probably many of them are. And so he had a very high level kind of view of the future of America.
Well, and that is one of the bigger concerns I have, is the education in this country and the fact that half the country thinks that any sort of education makes you a nerd, expertise is denigrated, and not for the purposes, Regis, of being a pointy-headed intellectual, but simply for being a human being for whom there is a baseline of intelligence derived from education, a broad-based education. I'm less concerned about the outcome of someone's education as the fact that I don't feel like enough of our kids are getting it.
Yeah, I think that's the important point. The outcome of education, I tell my grandkids when they were getting out of school, they didn't know where they were going to do or go. And I said, keep looking and it'll find you, because your talents will match whatever you enjoy doing and you'll follow that course. But I think that you have to have sort of a base. This is why I said philosophy was so important, because quite frankly, I used it a lot in my work. And even my sort of prime professor that I got my best education in philosophy from, you know, he was called on by many corporations to help them solve problems. You know, he had a number of degrees. He could look at it from multiple viewpoints, but it ultimately comes down to human issues and human engagement.
So General Mark Milley, who's the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was before a congressional committee, and I don't remember, it was one of the Republican goons who was giving him a hard time about whatever it was that day. And General Milley said, well, look, I've read Marx, I've read Mao, I've read Adams, I've read Jefferson. You know, I'm just going on the list here. He goes, because I want to understand different viewpoints, because if I don't understand them, how am I supposed to work with them or understand my adversaries? The understanding of someone who disagrees with you is not an acceptance of their viewpoint.
but a way to understand, okay, it's Mao's China. How do I deal with Mao's China? If it's the Soviet Union, if you don't have any baseline understanding of a communist system or how it came to be, how are you going to deal with them? It could be China today. And so the idea that you're just going to say, well, they're an adversary or an opponent or an enemy, therefore they're bad, and we must do everything we can to make sure that they're less bad, without any fundamental understanding of why they do things or how they do things, just sets yourself up for disaster, it feels like.
Yeah. And of course, they change the meaning of, for example, the word communism. So Social Security becomes communism.
Well, that was, you know, as we're recording this, Regis, earlier this week, President Biden made some remarks which he called some Republicans semi-fascists. And this sent the right-wing ecosystem absolutely into orbit, which means you can almost immediately tell that they're worried about it. Because as we know from these sorts of movements, they have to create that sort of insular world for their followers. And no one wants to, you know, I don't even think that a lot of people that watch Fox News want to be thought of as fascists. But to your point about communism, I mean, Republicans have been calling Democrats socialists and communists for decades. You know, most communist regimes, bloody as all hell throughout the years. And Democrats just sort of go like, that's ridiculous. Like, we're not communists.
I watched the McCarthy hearings.
Right. Well, listen, I mean, I guess, Regis, maybe that's a good point to leave is, you know, at long last, sir, you know, have these people no decency. You know, have these people no decency.
That's gone in my mind many times.
Right. Well, Regis, before I let you go, is there a place where everybody can find your collected work? Because there's a heck of a lot of it, and I'd love to make sure people got a chance to see it.
You know, a lot of the stuff that I collect is still in archives. I've turned 90% of it over to Stanford. And because of COVID and other reasons, they haven't been able to put the people on it to parse it. Plus, I think my own personal sort of notebooks, I want those to be available when I'm not here. There's a lot of conversations that I put in there that probably aren't appropriate to make public.
Well, let's hope it's a long time before those become public. But, well, Regis, listen, I want to thank you for joining me today. I want to thank you for a fascinating conversation, as you and I are always having. I feel like I'm lucky enough to have with you. As always, gang, you can find me online at Reed Galen on Twitter, at Reed_Galen_LP on Instagram. Until then, we'll see you next time. And Regis, thanks again. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter, at Project Lincoln, and for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. If you want to message the podcast directly, please send an email to podcast@lincolnproject.us. And if you want to personally join the fight to save our nation's democracy, visit jointheunion.us. Also, be sure to check out our growing LPTV lineup, including The Breakdown with Tara Settmeyer and Rick Wilson, which airs Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern. We're Speaking with Lisa Senecal and Maya May, which airs Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern. And Lunch with Lincoln, which airs every Monday at noon Eastern. Plus, we'd love you to check out our newest show, The Game We're In, with Maya May and Trigby Olson, which airs Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern. All shows you can stream live on The Lincoln Project's YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter feeds. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.